Hello and welcome to recording number 27 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 23rd, 2021. We've just seen Gord. It was Gord and Geller go out. They're in the Vesvi Forest. Now they've come up to the point where they're reaching the band. I'm assuming, of Abmi Keek and the Lossels, the Ape Orcs, Gnolls, and Half Orcs so far. And they've encountered them. Now, they're all pretty low level, so Gord did a pretty, pretty big chop down on the ones he encountered. But still, we found out that the band was more... instead of in the scores, it's more like in the hundreds. So even for a high-level character, that does bring problems where a horde of low-level characters, low-level creatures, could bring them down. So anyway, I'm going to restart right here. It's page 259, and it is the fourth paragraph from the end. Just as he was rising and turning to retrieve his blade from the back of the first of the ape orcs, Gord heard scrabbling and gasping sounds from the direction of the loss, from the direction the Lossels had come. What damned enemy now came? He jerked the sword free and spun, ready to strike. Old, a voice said softly, I've just done for the third of those things, and I think that's all that followed. It was the bard's voice, and Gord relaxed. Turt and the rest are just ahead, Gord whispered to Geller, as his friend stepped into view from behind the screen of brush that had separated them. All signaled them that were coming. The bard grabbed Gord and made a shushing sound. Don't do that, he admonished. I've heard the Lossels make a very similar call when they want their fellows to come. It seemed we picked a poor sound for recognition, he added ruefully. The two men trotted as quickly as they could, calling Chert's name softly as they went. Fortunately, Chert had been creeping toward the muted noises of combat with the Lossels, and the barbarian heard and recognized his friends calling immediately. Together, the three rejoined the two lads and led them deeper into the forest, going directly away from the humanoid pathway that ran through the Vesve's hidden interior. As they went, they worked up the whistle of a nightbird as their new recognition call. They wanted no more problems there, for what they faced was sufficient without the addition of bringing Lossels to them. What happened, Chert asked, when they were safely away from any likelihood of discovery. Tell us, please, begged Thatch and Shad. Did you kill all of them? Gord chuckled regretfully. I only wish we had, he said to his companions. We managed to bring an end to a half dozen of those filthy ape things, and a handful of other stinking humanoids as well, but there are hundreds left, I fear. Geller asked Gord several questions about his activity, and then related his own work. He had used druidical power to cause the tree roots in the area to form a spiky bed that had thrust up in the path of the party of marauders. That had been the cause of their consternation while Gord was attacking the rear of the party. The bard had then immediately begun a spell that was potent in the calling of wild things, especially fierce beasts and carnivores. He had had to work at it a long while, but its result was the summoning of a fair number of wild pigs to the scene. The swine naturally charged the humanoids, attacking without fear. Too bad there were Diomer crafters amongst the enemy ranks, Gord said. Did you see the response to the boars attacking? Magic flew thick and fast, I'll tell you. Even wild pigs deserve a better death than that meted out by those humanoids. Humanoids and worse, Gord interjected. I saw a bit of the display, too, and those casting came from no orcish dabbler in the arcane arts. There was a powerful magic worker there, and one or two lesser Diomer crafters too. The lads were listening with big eyes at this talk, but they remained quiet and showed expressions of determination despite all that had occurred. Shad asked in a small voice, "What are we going to do now?" Restgeller said practically, "In the morning we'll see if we can't work out a plan that will succeed against so powerful a collection of enemies." "We know one thing at least," Chert said heavily. "We do?" his young associate asked in surprise. "Sure," the barbarian replied. "All those orcs and lossels and gnolls, and spellcasters too, mean something certain, Gord. The second key must be with the collection of scum, or I'm a Medigean merchant's arse." Alright, break. That is the end of chapter 23, page 261. No one, we have a comment here that no one loves lossels. Now it had been mentioned earlier that deep into the Vesvi, Uz maintained paths, and they're all coming all the way down here because Tushum is the village where they left, and that is kind of just west of Crockport, maybe a little northwest up the coast, but really there's a long way to go. And so Uz seems to be maintaining these pathways in the forest of the Vesvi, very deep into it, where he's actually got some kind of trails and roadways for his forces to travel. Now, I think that the ape orcs and the lossels are a very interesting addition. And it does show that even without the trails, I think the lossels would be able to travel very quickly in the thick forest. But he's also sending troops of, some of them are half-orcs and other humanoids or demi-humans that are also using, under Uz's command. Because Uz seems to like having different mixtures of classes and races among his servants. All right. It does speak again. Now, Gord easily killed those two lossels he just encountered very quickly. And so he probably killed off at least a dozen, and then he used those flaming acorns that Curly Greenleaf had given him when they were preparing to go up against the Hierarchs and try to save Melf and everyone. So it's hard to tell how much damage they did. Now, we have Geller casting something like, I'm not quite sure what it is. It sounds like a wall of thorns, but placed across the ground. And that is what the this little force that was sent out from the main encampment ran into while Gord was chopping up their rear ranks. I'm not quite certain what spell, but Geller had mentioned he's a bard, so he has access to druidical magic, and he's a very high-level bard, so I'm not quite sure what he hit them with. All right. It is page number 263, the beginning of chapter 24, and I'm going to start here at the first paragraph. Night had fallen over the sprawling fastness of the Vesvi forest once again. The company of mixed humanoids pressed on in the darkness. The few humans within their ranks were allowed to march along the beaten path, with only occasional curses coming from them as they stumbled over tree roots and stepped upon one another in the blackness. Arboreal orcs swarmed ahead in the treetops to make certain that no enemy lay in wait for the rest of the band. Fully 80 fully 80 had such duty, and woe to the one who lagged. Another 20 were strung out to either side, likewise brachiating as flank protection. In the center of the whole group were Abmi and his henchman Keek, well protected by tough humanoids and their powers, of course. After the ambush and slaughter of so many of their rear scouts, Abmi had directed that the company of Gnolls be placed under the command of a half-breed orc who had some small skill at spells of clerical sort and great ability with assassin's weapons. There was also another renegade elf, albeit not much of a spellbinder, now assisting Keek. Abmi saw to it that these two were in motion, up and down the line, frequently. Any further attack would be met with sharp retaliation. The loss of 30 of these scum did not bother the dwarf a bit, but he disliked the reaction that Uz would certainly have upon hearing the news. Abmi had reports from his outlaw woodsman that there were no more than half a dozen men involved in the attack upon his party. The fact that one or more of them was obviously a considerable foe was immaterial. Face had been lost by the dwarf, and with it came a lessening of Uz's stature. Infinitesimal as this misfortune was, retribution would occur. Uz's anger must fall somewhere. The outlaw group moved more swiftly now, marching mostly by night and resting during the day. This allowed them to keep a better watch for those who followed and harassed, and it kept the scum too tired to fight amongst themselves, at every halt, too. Abmi was pleased with the arrangement. All right, break. So, you know, we see there's quite a band here because with 60 of these Lossals in the lead and 20 to each side, there's at least 100 left. And then there's a few demi-humans, humanoids, and woodsmen that make up the center of the band. That there's also Gnolls, and that they make up like the strong body of the band. So that is quite, you know, really quite a force that is traveling with Abmi right here. Now, we see that even this small loss, they lost about 30 of their number, but even this small loss, Abmi worries about because of the way, the nature of Uz, that Uz is certainly a very petty and fickle ruler. And it really speaks to the quality of servants he's going to get. Because if he is so readily going to punish, you know, his servants for, you know, losses against a very strong foe, then you would have to really think twice about swearing any kind of allegiance to Uz. Now, right away, there's mention of that pathway I was talking about and how it's allowing them to move even at night, and that they're able to, move forward, even though they're not woods-wise or these humanoids that he has with them. Now, it's commented here that Uz was reduced to hiring the Lossals. And yeah, you know, if there was any larger band, like say we were back to the 10 or 12 that originally started out, I think that they wouldn't think twice about taking on 100 Lossals. Because these Lossals are really, you know, they're nothing against the powers that they're coming up against. Especially if there was somebody like Melf around who has very powerful area effect spells, or if Curly Greenleaf were around who could cast the highest level of druid spells and, you know, certainly reduce these lower less powerful creatures. So we don't really know how big a group there is of humanoids and such around Omni, but if their bulk of their the scouting force are Lossals, then that's not a very powerful force, in the sense that they're not going to be able to stand up to really, I think any of these characters, if they strike, they're pretty much going to kill a Lossal. Now, the only positive thing I can see about the Lossals is that if you're using them as a scouting force, even if they die easily, they're a kind of buffer to alert anybody who wants to approach the main band around Omni. So, in that sense, that they're very good about going through the woods. They can climb high. They can move quickly through the woods. I think they're a very handy force to have with you, but definitely not, really strong. All right. Chris has put, it was mentioned, the brachiation, which is the movement of baboons are going to be able to move back and very quickly from their swinging arm to arm, and their legs and their feet being more like hands that can grip. So they're going to form a very nice force above the heads of most observers, because now Gord and Geller and Chert and the two boys, they're still trying to travel forward on horseback. All right.
Gary really understands anatomy. I mean, at least where it comes into monsters. I mean, it's neat how deep he goes.
Yeah, and it comes from, a lot of self-education by Gygax. So, he did, he was a self-educated man, I believe, and he did read lots of history. He was interested in all these various things. There was a very more respect for self-taught individuals in the past. Lincoln, he read for the bar rather than studying for it. He simply was reading the law books. And Lovecraft, if you get to his last story, one of his last story, At the Mountains of Madness, it's about this scientific group, and he really is up on the science of the time, and it's an amazing, well put together story, and lots of mentions of the advances in technology that were happening at the time, and yet he makes a truly horrific book. But in the very end of that book, what he's pointing out is that even though these elder ones were of a different shape, that even though they were monstrous in form, they were more akin to humanity than the mythos creatures were akin to those elder ones. So, it turned the story into a kind of science over the power of scientific things over the power of the kind of semi-occult mythos creatures. So here, what we're seeing is Gygax using all the things he had read and absorbed about our real world, and bringing it out and using every bit of it, I think, in the game system. Now, it was commented in regular chat that, in the book one, Gygax obviously wasn't familiar with horses. And then later on, by the time we reached the beginning of Artifact of Evil, Gygax was much more aware of you would have to lead your horses in the forest, how you wouldn't be able to ride them, ride them endlessly, or, so he had probably been, people had mentioned to him that he wasn't really projecting the way that horses would be able to work in a forest. And I think that was, you know, very well, you know, a well done change that he came out with for the second book here. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 264. And it is the second paragraph. The outlaw group moved more swiftly now, marching mostly by night and resting during the day. This allowed them to keep a better watch for those who followed and harassed, and it kept the scum too tired to fight amongst themselves at every halt, too. Amin was pleased with this arrangement. In the 24 hours since he had slain the wild boars and then driven off the attacking men, Abmi had covered as many miles. Should there actually be a larger force than the handful the stupid scouts reported as having caused the trouble, then these enemies would have to run to keep up. Moving a mass of troops through this sort of terrain was slow work, and the dwarf cursed the fact that he had but a few hundred under his command. If he had thousands, he would not need to run as if chased by devils, while with only a score or two, he could move much more swiftly. It almost seemed as if there was a plot to discomfit him. Had Abmi not understood the nature of the thing he carried to Uz, he would, in fact, suspect the Cambion of trying to be rid of him. At every turn in the path, it seemed that another handful of humanoids joined his force, adding little to its real strength and slowing its progress disproportionately as they were fitted into the command in any hodgepodge fashion. Why couldn't he get some powerful spellbinders to augment this ragtag regiment? With these and a few ogres or trolls, he'd be able to get through the forest in speed and style. Rot your balls, Klabdol, the dwarf shouted to the half-orc who rode near Keek. Move your worthless butt ahead there, and see what all that fuss is about. Quick! There was something happening in the trees ahead. Abmi's vision didn't extend that far, but the cries of the ape-orcs and the noise told him that all was not well. The half-orc priest went off immediately. Keek was giggling at the fear he'd seen in the fellow's ugly face. Shut up, Keek. Stop that goddamned cackling instantly, roared Abmi. The skinny elf snapped his mouth closed and looked at Abmi. Master, as you wish, he intoned solemnly, then burst into a fresh torrent of high-pitched laughter. That's enough, you long-eared turd-eater, Abmi fumed. You take your worthless elvish ass and get to the tail end of this gaggle of scum. If there's trouble ahead, it's probably a ruse. Any real attack will hit the rear. Be there and stop it if it comes, understand? As if I'd thought of it myself, Lord Abmi, Keek called as he turned his horse and urged it along, yelling at hulking gnolls to clear a path for him or be castrated. The column halted in confusion, and Abmi swore more loudly still. That must be Klabdol screwing around with the advance, the dwarf reckoned. There was no other reason for the commotion in the trees. For the commotion in the trees had ceased, and no sounds of battle came from ahead. It was time to take a direct hand. Abmi got his mount moving, heading for the front of the confused band. What's the reason for this halt? He demanded. Klabdol materialized from behind a tree, an arboreal ape in tow. He bowed and said, Pardon, Lord, but I called it, for the lossels had come down from the trees and were refusing to return. What? Those miserable half-apes wouldn't dare such a thing. You there, the dwarf said to the cowering creature, held fast by the brutish priest-assassin. Speak or die. Did you and your fellows do as the priest claims? Abmi spoke carefully in Orcish, for these arboreal humanoids were more stupid than their cousins, if that was possible. Worse still, as simian as were the orcs, these crossbreed ones were even more ape-like, as and their outthrust jaws, baboon-like muzzles, and large canine teeth made their halting speech difficult to understand. Leave it to that perverted cambion to develop such a species as these so-called lossals. Ah, it killed Zuff, the ape-orc said, and it tried to grin to see if that would end the matter. This was going to take a bit of time, Abmi realized. What do you mean, it? Tell me what killed? Zuff, the lossal supplied. Uggerzuff, the dwarf, nearly screamed at the stupid creature. What was it that killed him? The lion that was in the trees killed Zuff. That's what. Good. Ain't good Zuff being chewed up like that, the lossal countered, and then cringed when he saw Abmi point his hammer at him. Listen, you moronic mongrel, the dwarf spat without raising his voice. Now you tell me exactly what happened, and do it slowly and quickly. Otherwise I will split your louse-ridden cranium, feed the small contents to those gnolls there, and ask another of your comrades to give me the information I require. You may begin now. The lossal couldn't understand half of what the terrible little dwarf said, but he understood the threat in Abmi's tone all too well. Ah, we was going long, pretty easy like, nothing to see, no stuff to hurt us. Zuff, he was the first of us, so he's the one who says, look out, chums, there's a lion. Lions don't climb around in trees, Abmi interjected. Did you actually see the animal? The what? The lion. Go on with your report, you idiot. A sure thing. I seen the lion. It was a blackie, and didn't have no mane. It was just sitting and looking at us all. Then, Zuff, he flung his club at the lion, and tried to jump back in where we was. That's when it got hold of him, and chewed up old Zuff in a big bite. What did the rest of you do? Demanded the dwarf. Shit, what do you expect? We pitched our clubs at that friggin' cat real good. Me, I hit him right on the schnozzle. Couple of the boys, they had them funny little bows you give 'em. Wang, wang, they lets loose and the sticks fly right into the bastard's side like, only they don't sink in. Just like the clubs, the arrows ain't to doin' no hurt to the lion. So, that big cat, he looks at us boys like we just patted his head. Then he opens his mouth, all covered with Zuff's blood. And I saw that thing grin, scariest thing I ever seen. Then we got down from the trees, quick-like, and none of us going back till that cat's meat on the table. Abmi struck the lossal as hard as he could with the ensorcelled hammer. The blow sufficed to kill the stupid creature instantly, and it never knew what struck it. All the others were watching, He glared at these ape orcs from a visage filled with rage. There may or may not be some big cat, a leopard probably, up there in the trees, he said threateningly. But I'm here. Even you dim-witted monkeys can see that. I will certainly kill you all if you do not get back into those branches overhead and resume your work. You will move ahead, watch for enemies, and tell me if you see any. If there is a cat up there, you will slay it, or else I will have others do so. No matter. Now get going. All right, break. We have, again, more of this business where the evil characters, they're just as apt to slay their own forces as they are to attack anyone else. So here we have Obmi crossing off another of the losses, which, you know, in a sense isn't a big thing, but they are their scouts, and they are their buffer to warn them of anything coming up ahead or to the sides. Now, I have a little hard time with the lossal speak that Gygax came up with. And, you know, I know he likes fooling around with vernaculars that he's using so that he can make them a little distinct. But, you know, I had a little bit of a hard time with the lossal speak. We are getting an example of what good the Lossals can be for, because they are providing the scouting service, and obviously, you know, they run into something, a big creature strong enough to kill one of them, and which, if you read what's going on, that and believe what this this Lossal was saying, that they were hitting, the clubs were actually hitting the cat, the arrows were actually hitting the cat, the leopard ahead, and yet not appearing to do any damage. So, if you pick up that cue, you can kind of see that they must be talking about some kind of enchanted cat that has a resistance of some kind to normal weapons. All right. I am going to restart. It's page number 267. And it is paragraph, let's see, 1, 2, 3. The third paragraph from the top. The Lossals bounded up into the branches quickly, and that was the end of it. "Get going, the rest of you," Obmi shouted. "You'll trot for the next hour to make up for the delay. Stragglers and laggards will be killed." A quarter of an hour passed, and then a new commotion occurred at the head of the company. The cause was the black leopard again, and this time Obmi had to use his hammer on two of the frightened arboreal orcs before the rest could be forced back into the trees again. Now Obmi was certain that the creature was a werecat of some sort. Knowing this, he called to the thin-faced elf to settle the matter. "Teek, you're going to take charge of the advance. Keep a close eye on what's going on above. Shout, for a were-leopard seems to be stalking the Lossals. Bad taste in food habits, I'd say, but it is disrupting things inordinately. If the kitty shows its whiskers again, pluck them." Keek smiled at the prospect. "Any preferences to how I kill the thing? Why should I care?" The stick-like figure shrugged his narrow shoulders. "I thought you might like to have its hide for a saddle covering," Keek cackled. "But if it's no matter, I'll blast its balls off with a lightning bolt." "Bah, Just do it and be quiet. When another disturbance came a half hour later, Keek was there and ready. This ob me knew, for a great flash and the sizzling crack of the stroke of blazing electricity gave clear evidence that the elven spellcaster had done just what he'd said. The dwarf smiled and smiled to himself and went ahead to view the body. A half dozen charred losels were scattered on the ground, but there was no corpse of man nor body of cat. Let's see. What occurred? The dwarf asked with a calmness he did not feel. Keek looked sick. The bolt missed, he said through thin lips. These unfortunate apelings, inquired Obmi mildly, as he eyed the smoking remains of the losels. They were in the path of the stroke, or else in the tree, and took too much electricity and died, Keek replied with a wince as the dwarf stared unwinkingly at him. That bastard cat is fast, Lord Obmi, the elven mage hastened to add. It watched me stand near and begin my casting. Just as I loosed the stroke, it leaped away, vanished, possibly. I don't know. It's very smart. It leaped. I don't know. It's very smart, and more than any werebeast I've ever seen. And you know I have slain my share. Obmi nodded at that and reslung his hammer. Keek did not make stupid errors like that without cause. Angry as he was, Obmi valued the elf too much to waste him for no purpose other than the satisfaction of frustrated ire. Too much, far too much, was at stake in this whole game for him to make foolish misjudgments or allow rage to blind him. See that the column is halted. Get sentries out. Make sure that we are as well protected as possible. When that's done, come back to me at once, dear Keek. You and I must work together on a plan to solve our problems. The elf bowed and hurried off, relieved that Obmi bore him no malice for the failure. Too bad, he mumbled to himself as he went. Too bad, the runt didn't have the balls to go after the black devil of a cat himself. Then he'd find out a thing or two. Hammers or no, that leopard would have a dwarf for dinner. Then I would be a commander and bring the prize to Lord Uz. What power I would have then. Continuing to mull over the pleasant reflection, the elven renegade went about his duties. In the hours just preceding dawn, Obmi and Keek worked out a plan plan of action. As they huddled in conference, there were several more incidents, but after a scream and the following commotion, the black killer went elsewhere to strike down. The black killer went elsewhere to strike again. It didn't matter. The cat creature seemed unwilling to come near the center of the party, and that meant that it was most certainly vulnerable to spell and weapon, at least those enchanted weapons wielded by Obmi, a Keek, and a few others of the officers of the motley collection of humanoids. Let us summon Cladbull, Flug, and the Nolish Captain. Har Half, then. The name is Har Harath, Lord, Keek corrected the dwarf politely, being careful not to giggle. I'll bring them here at once. You're certain this will work? Obmi asked again. I see no flaw, Lord Obmi. Rise. Let's see. Get them then and hurry. All right, break. This is the end of chapter 24, page 269. All right, we have, Chris has put up a picture of the of a leopard, and give you a general idea. There's also the spell lightning bolt up here. Now, there's a question about lightning bolts missing. Lightning bolts are, like fireballs, are directional spells. You point and fire kind of thing. I think your big choice is that you can choose, say, the starting point to up to a certain degree. And like for lightning bolt, that's mainly so that if you're in an area, you can try to get it to bounce back. If it hits like a wall and comes back, it can double damage, certain creatures. The closest you get really is a saving throw. And I think that the saving throw is only like 50%. But, if you are casting a fireball or a lightning bolt, it can certainly envelop your own troops because it's an area effect spell. It's just going to expand. And you can try, you're basically directing it in a certain path. And if you've mismeasured, your eyeball mismeasuring, then like in the more spherical fireball, you can trap your own people within the sphere. Or with a lightning bolt, usually what happens is it would either be that Keek really didn't care about including the Lossals in the attack. Now, it's entirely possible that Gord is so quick that he was able to move out of the range or off to one side or another of the course of the lightning bolt. But it's also possible that in cat form that he might have a high resistance to spells, such as that, and be able to take the damage or, simply avoid, the shape of the expanding lightning bolt.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think he was quick enough to be able to get out of the way of the line. So he was able to get out of the area of effect.
Yeah, because what you get with a lightning bolt is you're seeing it's not a... the fireball not only goes out, but it also goes in a sphere. But yeah, and as is a question, I wonder if magic resistance is being hinted at. Possibly, but also the lightning bolt is going to be much more narrow. And, if Gord's speed and his ability to go the distance, he may be able to see Keek getting ready to cast the spell and simply go to one side or another to avoid it before the spell is actually cast. Now, as a lightning bolt, once it's cast, it should be moving at such a rate that it would be very hard to move out of the way. And, as Chris says, Gord really is, he's got so many abilities. He has enchanted weapons, he has enchanted armor, and especially he has that cat's eye ring, which really holds a lot of powers in it. So it's very hard to tell, what his write-up would be at this point. He's also very dexterous, which is also aided by the ring, his dexterity. He's going to react. If you're doing like spell casting time, he is going probably be the first in a combat round, probably the first creature to react with his extraordinary agility. All right. I am going to restart. We're on page 271. Chapter 25 is just beginning, and it is paragraph 1. "Meow," said Chirp. Gord shot the hillman a dark scowl that threatened mayhem. "It isn't funny, Chirp. Stop it," the bard said, just managing to suppress a smile. Gord looked at both men disdainfully. What I managed was more than either or both of you could have done. Besides, if you think it's a joke to creep through an encampment of towering humanoids as a little pussycat in order to overhear what's being said, you try it. We can't, the barbarian said with a broad grin of contentment. As you yourself pointed out, only you can manage the trick. Thatch and his small companion, Shad, were sitting cross-legged nearby. They had listened solemnly to the tale of Gord's using the ring to take cat form. They were frightened by rare creatures of any sort, the very thought making them shudder. Yet this man who told them about turning into a huge black leopard and killing Lossels thereby was a friend. And Lossels were awful things. They could only listen and withhold judgment. It seemed there was a whole lot more to the world than Tushum Village and being successful hunters. Both lads listened carefully, not only because the story was exciting and full of magic, but Both lads listened carefully, not only because the story was exciting and full of danger, but because they wanted some clue about the treasure. So far they had seen more of trouble with evil humanoids and the like than folk were ever expected to. The reward must be really terrific for these men to go through all this sort of danger just to get the key. What would the dragon be like? Thatch looked at Shad, and Shad stared back for a moment. There was an unspoken exchange then, both boys wishing they hadn't decided to set out into the forest as hunters quite so soon. All right, break. We get here. Here's an example of how these two boys are looking at the world. Kind of like the way Gord was when he was very young, you know, seen through a city boy with Gord. But here we have these two village boys. And if you talk of treasure, they think dragon. So Gygax is showing that the world around them, you know, that not everybody is all that knowledgeable about these various monstrous creatures. And there's some who are much rarer than others. So to these boys, the tales they're hearing are about dragons and gold, and whether or not they're really encountered, it really speaks to the kind of folk tales that villagers should have, and these young boys should be aware of. And so they have a very disjointed view of the world, even though they're living up in the wilds, and it's something you can definitely add as part of the lore of the campaign. Because more than just what the story is telling, this is telling what the culture of these little villages like, and what the boys think about the world.
And also, it's similar to how I was when I first read this.
Yes, and, you know, it's... one of the earliest fantasy that I read were the Tolkien books, The Hobbit, and then The Lord of the Rings a little later. And, it says so, the kind of thing in The Hobbit as well. When, Bilbo first encounters Gandalf, he has this idea about how Gandalf used to talk perfectly sensible young hobbits to go off and have adventures. And, in a sense, when I was first reading these, the very early adventures, the Conans, the Fritz Lieber stuff, it is You develop this idea of what adventure is, and you hear things about the world you live in that are, urban legends, and you hear, old tales and old riddles and old songs. It's probably very different now. A lot of the stuff when I grew up in the 60s that I'd hear, there was still, the world had been moving forward so quickly that there were still remnants of the old world. Before
you probably heard stories of the Jersey Devil and stuff, right?
Yes, and various things about ghosts and various little songs and stuff that are now gone. There was one little joke about this Big Jim, and there were, various little things that you heard. That I think that the culture has been rapidly changing, so that stories that you might have heard in the 60s that might have come up from the 19th century, I don't think they're part of the culture anymore. So what you get then is a more modern outlook on things today, but from a very short culture. So what these boys are talking about is the culture that you can kind of expect to see within the Greyhawk campaign. And since, it's a very important thing, because you're going to be, as DM, running the game and running all the NPCs. So you've got to develop some kind of society that you're going to express to the players, and then give the players some kind of expectation. And yeah, Chris is putting up the old Jersey Devil, which I it's funny. I've heard a little bit more about it on popular shows now, but back in the past, it really was something really just a New Jersey little legend. And down, if you know, the Pine Barrens back then were actually more wild, and when I grew up, there were still. In central Jersey, there was still farmland right up in central Jersey, all of which today is long gone. So, the world is, has really, really changed. But in any case, this is a very good material for you to use as a DM to flush out your campaign, so that when the characters go on an adventure, it gives you the idea. Now, recently, they've released material, the Ghosts of Saltmarsh, that include these, strange non-human characters, a half-demon and a half-dragon. And it's not that those kind of characters can't be fit into a campaign, but the easiest thing is to have them be strange to the characters that the NPCs and villages and that they encounter in the Flaness, because if you want to move that all those creatures in as player characters, then it becomes much harder, because you have to change all the reactions and the nature of the entire setting. And not that that's impossible, but it'd be easier to run those creatures, the half dragons and the half demons, as something that would cause a stir. You keep the way that the setting is set up as more medievalish fantasy, with where something like that, an unfamiliar kind of creature, would be like a little legendary to see. And where, the more dwarves and elves and gnomes and hobbits and even orcs would be much more mundane. But when you start getting into some of these monstrous creatures and then used as player characters, it's easier to run them. Players can run them, but then have to face the reaction by culture in the setting as it's been written up. The nice thing about Greyhawk, though, is that if you want to do the work, you can alter the entire campaign to your style. All right. Let me see. I am going to restart. And it is page 272, second paragraph. "That foul little dwarf is a wily one," Geller said. "If he has done as he said, we must either separate or find a way to get rid of the gnolls quickly." "Pardon, Master Geller, but what are gnolls?" Thatch asked. Chur answered before the bard could speak. "Nasty dog-faced things as big as I am. They're mean killers, too, and would cheerfully roast you two over a fire." "That boy's," Geller added, "is no exaggeration, and they'd eat you too after they were done. All that as it is, we'll see to it that you never have to face any gnolls until you're able to deal with them on terms they find not to their liking." "Like Master Gord did to the Lossels," Shad said eagerly. Gord was somber. "You'd not like that much, Shad. Geller means that when you're grown fully trained to fight properly, and have armor and all, you and Thatch there will be more than a match for a pair of gnolls." The boy sat back, feeling bigger and more confident. All right, so, you know, again, we have, like, the two boys being given an example as, like, a zero-level character. They're getting kind of on-the-job training here. We see this training is a little more haphazard, but very practical. You know, so far they've only really put their blades into the tusker that Gord had been fighting with. But still, they've actually managed to score hits on a, I think, like a four-hit-die monster there. So they're learning quite a bit, and they're being taught. And you see here that they don't know what a gnoll is. And that's actually a wonderful thing. I mean, it's very good to be able to describe to the first time to, say, like a new player, you know, that you've encountered something you haven't known before. Even if they have knowledge from, say, like reading a monster manual, which a player really shouldn't do, they really, you know, the character shouldn't really know everything that, say, a DM knows, everything that's in a monster manual, or if they've read an adventure and have an idea. That really is a spoiler. And if you're going to be a player, it's best to go in as with just the knowledge that you should have, and no extra knowledge. So Gygax is really giving a good example with Thad, Thatch and Shad, how 2-0 level young characters can make their way to first level and gain this experience. But again, they have to be heavily protected, because neither boy is going to be a match for anything, even as much as a Lossal, let alone a Gnoll. It's also Gygax showing how the game mechanics can fit into the story and, you know, be brought up in a broad respect, where that Gord and Chur and Geller are promising them that if they gain experience in the meaning both of game mechanic and in, say, story, you know, in gameplay, both as a matter of lore and a matter of game mechanics, that they will advance to the point sensibly that they'll be able to fight off a gnoll. Because, like, later on, when you think of it, how could, you know, like a regular-sized human be able to take on a giant? And yet, later on in the game, somebody like Chert, he's already stronger and more dangerous than a hill giant. He's higher level, attacks more. But if you see them face off against each other, even, you know, even Chert, as big as he is, you know, like the size of a teenager compared to a hill giant, and like a child compared to, you know, the bigger giants. And yet, he certainly could take them on. This is the way Gord has of explaining the business of increasing experience, in that the experience is a real it's both a game mechanic and a real situation. Well, it's 7 o'clock, I'm a little beat tonight, so I'm not going to be able to hang on. I'm sorry, my narration was a little off. I kept losing my place here, I'm going to have to make a quick night of it. So,
I'm going to call. Thanks for reading.
Oh, thank you. All the comments and what you're doing, bringing up all this stuff in the text, and it's just an incredible addition to these commentaries. And I like to think that we're really doing something historical here. I mean, on the one hand, I think we're all learning much more than we would before, but we're also participating in something that I'm really surprised hasn't really been done before. And so it's going to be there, a little raw form that we have it now. But we are now 45 hours for the first book, and we're 27 hours now into this other book. By the time we finish, we'll be closing on 80 or 90 hours worth of recording and commentary. And I think that's absolutely amazing, and it's a real legacy for everything here. Well,
I'm going a little harder at it than I normally would. Like that one word for the brachiation. I thought I knew what that was, but then when I looked it up, it was something completely different. I was like, wow, it's good that I did that.
Yes, same here. Same here. I thought the brachiation was something different about splitting the group, not about the style of movement. So
The way they were talking about it, they were talking about large parties, and I thought it might have been a military maneuver.
Yeah, there is a thing like about splitting a group into two parts, but this definitely was not it. All right, good night. I'm good night. Craig.